Hello and welcome back to another edition of Editing Aloud. And before we get into any content in the papers today, because it happened too late for them, panel, last night was pretty special in South Africa, the launch of Peter Louis Myburgh's book, Gangster State, detailing in with real professionalism the sort of, you know, the crimes against the state of one Ace Magashule. The launch at the Sandton Exclusive Books was disrupted by people wearing ANC t-shirts and ANC regalia shouting Ace, 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 tearing the book up and genuinely, I think the launch had to be abandoned. And apparently the Free State Youth League has now invited people to come and burn the book with them, except they don't want to buy any books themselves. So you have to apparently take your own if you want to burn it. I mean, clearly, you know, there are people around, and we know this, you know, young people in our politics who are completely clueless. But Patrick, do you think last night was a sort of watershed moment for South Africa?
A watershed, maybe, Peter, but it's been coming. I mean, there have been so many instances, both during the election period and before, where it's quite clear that the if you like, the spirit of intolerance is rising. You've had meetings disrupted, posters, rival parties' posters pulled off poles and trees, etc.
That happens in all elections, doesn't
it? It happens, and you know, possibly
I mean, chair throwing has been going on for two decades now.
Well, I remember reading Herman Charles Bosman.
Yeah.
The chair throwing at the Johannesburg City Hall. You had to...
And they weren't plastic in those days.
No, they
were hard.
They really do some damage.
You had to arm yourself with what he called a stick stool before you engage the meeting. Yeah, so I guess it's kind of more of the same, possibly with more intensity as we move towards... move towards May 8th.
Yeah.
The book burning, I mean, again, a bit of a racial element there at Exclusive Books, ordering the whites out of the shops, etc. And now, as you say...
How different would the book burning be to, say, burning the art, Larry, at UCT? And I remember particularly because one of the paintings that was burnt was of Molly Blackburn, whose death by the hands of the security police in 1988, I think, caused the biggest single funeral ever seen in Port Elizabeth.
I think the book burning is actually quite serious because we've kind of almost gotten used to a kind of like temperature, like a hostile temperature towards journalists.
Mm.
But now we've all seen it ramp up a bit. What's next after book burning? Banning journalists? Where's the next point in the kind of the heating up of the assault on journalism?
What, Julieta, were you convinced at all by the ANC statement? I mean, you had everybody presumably having to get their act together quite quickly last night after the event. They did put out a statement condemning it.
Well, they distanced themselves.
Yes.
And isn't that difference to outright condemnation where President Cyril Ramaphosa stands up and says, we draw a line in the sand. This is totally unacceptable. This is not what we fought for. And interestingly enough, I saw Jackson and Tembu on Twitter saying, our hard fought and hard won democracy is completely tarnished by an action such as this.
So he got it more right.
So he got it more right. Yeah. But you need to see that, I think, from the very top, where you can't just distance yourself. You actually have to go outright.
I wonder sometimes when you'll have an ANC, you'll have a terrible disaster occur, and somebody from the ANC will say that it's very unfortunate. And I wonder whether it's just a sort of a language thing, whether people aren't able to express themselves as vividly as maybe they sometimes need to. I mean,
I think you're giving them too much benefit of
yeah,
the doubt, Peter.
Really. So their English is good enough to call something appalling when it is appalling.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Today's Financial Mail, or this week's Financial Mail, Richard Calland, who we all know, is very clever. He's the professor. He's a professor in public law at UCT. He's done a sort of report card on Cyril Ramaphosa, and he's given him. This is just 3 weeks ahead of the election, obviously. He's given Ramaphosa 62% for the job so far. And Larry, you had some strong feelings about his chart. It's quite nicely done.
I like the chart. I like the ranking. I like the way it was laid out. It's kind of, we always don't know where the presidency is because in his governance, and this actually kind of gives us something to work with. What I would have liked is to have some kind of weighting to some of the aspects of the things that make up the final score. So, is criminal justice more important than land reform or the mining sector? We know this is kind of a nebulous thing if you want to give a ranking to weighting specific to any of these functions. But it would be nice to know whether the things that he has to do that move the most, the quickest on. This is a thing. His ranking should be. Yeah. Some of the stuff can be kicked. I mean, some of the stuff will take a couple of years to sort out, and we can give him some scope for that. But what's the thing that he has to do right now in the next year or so? That's the thing I want to know. That's the thing I want to know. What's the most important thing he has to move on as quickly?
What do you think it is?
I would say probably.
If you could pick one,
the ESCOM.
Okay.
I think ESCOM is the bellwether of this country at the moment.
How do you? And does anybody have any? Have you read anything? Anybody have any ideas about how to what you do? I mean,
I think that's what we've seen over the when we saw the management of ESCOM and the minister of public works kind of give a presentation on what was happening at ESCOM. It didn't exactly fool me with confidence, to be honest.
Yeah, they seem to have made Juliet a clear decision. They're going to finish Kusile and Medupi, right?
They said there's no going back.
Yeah, there's no going back. Whereas, in fact, they could just stop. Now, there'd be a cost to stopping, but it would be the end of fixing it.
Yeah.
So the maintenance could go back to the old power stations, which money is now being eaten up by finishing Kusile and Medupi. I mean, I'm told, and I don't know, I haven't spoken to him personally, but people who have reckon that Brian Darmes' advice would be to stop now on those two things. Write them off and go with what you've got and pack as much, as much time into the existing coal power stations as you could. Take that shocked look off your face.
Well, I'm just thinking of the very many ramifications of that step.
Yeah.
So firstly, you write off a couple of hundred billion and you say that's money wasted. But also the problem is that Medupi and Kusile were to some extent vanity projects. Mm. You know, the big projects they're almost like apartheid era, the building of the Johannesburg General Hospital. You know, we are going to build Africa's biggest coal-fired power stations, and now we've stuffed it up.
Mm.
So, you can't let that happen. We can't stuff it up. So we are just, we are committed, we are yoked to this, and we can't let
these things
go. It's
like bowling bounces that somebody keeps scoring sixes off you every time the ball goes past his head.
Well, you just used a cricket analogy, so that's completely over the top of my head.
Unfortunately. Well, I mean, it's basically doing the same thing over and over again and hoping for a better result.
I mean, there's 36, so I think it was, 18 billion rand to finish each. I stand to be corrected.
Well, I mean, any number that they give you to finish it, you can double.
Sure. Okay. So then you think, okay, well, can we afford this? So maybe that's where you have to say, can we actually afford to continue building rather than and just simply ignore the cost of the money that's sunk into these assets?
I mean, the reason they were built was because you remember that the ANC decided back in 97 not to build when ESCOM said it should.
Mm-hmm.
And ESCOM said, if you don't build now, this was in 1997, in 2007, you'll run out of electricity. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were a year out. Mm. I mean, it was absolutely spot on.
But I feel, Peter, I mean, regardless of those details, the point to me is that as long as ESCOM is run as an ideologically driven monopoly, it doesn't matter whether we finish Kusile, whether we finish Medupi. What they really should be doing is introducing some competition, breaking up aspects of ESCOM. And if it comes to the worst, Medupi, Kusile, you say, right, these are for sale to the bidder. You put in your bids. What have you got planned for these things?
In a way, that is happening. I mean, Ramaphosa's decided to break it up. He'll introduce competition from the point of a generation. I think the network does need to be controlled by the state. It needs to be needs to buy, Julieta?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is that aspect, and I am no electrical engineer, so if but on the
Jesse Duarte, so you're just a journalist.
Yes. But ideologically, I mean, I think Patrick's absolutely right. And ideologically, though, the ANC has this problem where it wants to insert itself. It can't let go.
Yeah.
It's got this. It's got this Soviet era Stalinist way of thinking, where it sees itself at the center of every economic action in South Africa, and that is so. It's totally outdated, and it's clearly failed.
So what I found amusing about this idea that if a thing like providing electricity, for example, is really important, then only the state can do it. And yet we deal with so many really important things like food, like clothing, that have no state involvement. And
this is part of the divide inside the ANC. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like Tony Blair arriving into the Labour Party. Mm. He had to get the trade unions out of the way before he could reform the party. What do you think of this ranking, Julieta? 62.3
What does Richard Cullen say here? I'd probably say he deserved an upper second, and that a lower second was a bit hard on him. I think Richard is probably in your camp, Peter, because he's giving Cyril the benefit of the doubt. And I think maybe restoring confidence in the presidency. So there's this table in the FM, 9.5 out of 10. I think maybe that's fair, clearing up the criminal justice sector, empowering Chapter 9 bodies, 8.5 out of 10. Not bad. Land reform, I totally agree, 2.5 out of 10.
Mm. Where's land reform?
It's halfway down the page. And
except it starts to improve, doesn't it, this year? January, February, March, his marks improve. So he goes from very poor to...
To good. I'm not sure how you arrived at that conclusion, because actually in the budget, there was very little allocated towards land reform. And I've written on land reform before. No more
except
than 1%.
They left your name of the story.
They left my... oh, well.
So land reform, he improves slightly. He gets very low marks for fiscal stability. Forging a new social compact and engagement with social partners, he fails. And he fails managing factional disputes with key provincial structures of the ANC. I'm not sure that that's a fail. Basically, he's moved all his problem people in the provinces are now on the parliamentary list. So that'll kind of move the problem to another
dimension.
To another dimension.
It'll move the problem to all of us. Gee, thanks. But Peter, if I may just finish my point on land reform. In the national budget, I certainly was expecting much more money to be allocated towards land reform. If land reform is become, so it was such a hot potato and a hot political issue in 2018, then to allocate virtually no money towards it, introduces cognitive dissonance of an extreme level.
But if you're talking about land reform without compensation, why would you have to budget for it?
Because that's the thing. But just a last point, the ANC government has never budgeted more than 1% of the national budget on land reform, which has to tell you how it views
where it isn't. So what are its highest allocations, Larry? What are they? Education?
Education
gets the most, I think.
Health? Social security,
health,
social security,
health. Yeah, I think it's just like the.
I mean, one of the great tragedies of our budgeting is the Defence Force, which is now capable of doing almost nothing. We had two helicopters to send into Mozambique. Mm-hmm. That was it, and one Hercules transport. That's.
So what was the arms deal about then?
The arms deal.
Yeah.
No, well, I mean, this is the thing. There's a very good piece I noticed in the Mail and Guardian the other day, basically saying there is one ship of the ones that were bought during the arms deal, capable at a time of doing any sort of maritime patrolling for piracy, for ships fishing illegally.
And that hasn't changed. We've still got one ship available.
And
our submarine, one of the submarines, I think, is still in dry dock.
One's got dry dock and one hit the bottom too hard.
But the arms deal was a money-making scheme dressed up as a necessary procurement exercise, which it never was. And I'm afraid a lot of our schemes seem to be a little bit like that.
So,
to put it delicately.
A couple of things out of the newspapers today. Rio Tinto's announced a big project in South Africa. I think Anglo recently did as well. No? I mean, Why would you spend $6.5 billion in South Africa now?
Well, I suppose when you Richards Bay Minerals, which is the project into which the investment is being made, accounts, according to Lisa Stain's article, for 25% of the world's titanium feedstock, 33% of zircon output. Because even though we have political risk, we also have the metals and the minerals that the world needs. And one just has to.
But isn't it interesting that it allows Gwede Mantashe? This is a guy who, you know, literally says anything that comes to mind it affirms South Africa's attractiveness as an investment destination, and its quote stable and predictable and regulatory environment, which is completely ridiculous. We know that there's no such thing, but he can say it without. Without any contradiction. Does nobody call him up or call up anybody to comment on that? Patrick,
it's the mystery.
Georgia has just committed the ultimate sin of not switching off his telephone on live television. But it's no problem. There's also, and I noticed Larry and Julieta, the IMF cutting its growth forecast for South Africa. So we were looking at 1.4 and 1.7, 1.4 this year and 1.7 next year, and they've cut it to 1.2 to 1.5. We don't have any good investment story to tell. Why Moody's didn't downgrade us, they've sort of explained, but presumably what Moody's is doing is just basically taking a big bet on Ramaphosa as well.
I think Moody's is like a parent. It's like a parent that's like trying to explain away a child's gambling problem.
Yeah.
I actually feel that they said no. He's committed to transforming. He's going for counselling. He's not going to the casino anymore. It feels like that's what Moody's is doing. It's not actually kind of. It's kind of in a little bit in denial.
Which is interesting because a lot of hard money decisions are based on.
Yeah.
The investment grade rating that these ratings agencies allocate. So, I hope the rest of the world's fund managers are as forgiving as old Moody's.
You know, oddly enough, it may also be an indication that they don't take our politics that seriously.
Do we take our politics too seriously?
And maybe we take it too seriously. And you look at the Rio Tinto thing. Obviously, there's stuff we have in South Africa. There's opportunities, and we're a big important country in Africa, and Africa's an important continent in the global supply chain. They can't just leave us out. You know, there does come a point where they do have to kind of get in, and maybe they don't really.
I mean, if Rio Tinto had read my Twitter timeline, they'd have all gone out and shot themselves rather than invested 6.5 billion rand in mineral sands here.
Well, thank you. Peter, you and I are doing our collective effort to depress the potential or to repel potential investors.
Is there a case, Larry? I mean, you're a hopeful chap. Is there a case for not giving up and not despairing completely? I mean, we're not broken.
We're not broken, but where
today.
Are we in this country? Okay,
yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out: like, are we in South Africa in the 80s or South Africa in the 90s? If we were to look at South Africa in the 80s, we'd have a similar story as we're saying now. You know, South Africa we're not investing enough. There's poverty. There's identity, the education systems are not fixed. But at the same time, in the 80s, we weren't a democracy. We weren't kind of locked into the world economy. There was no kind of institutional framework to solve the problems. At least now there are the ways there is something we can do to solve the problems. As I said before, my big concern is Eskom. I spoke to my local laundry, the guy that runs my local laundry, and he said that. I asked him how did he deal with the load shedding that happened? He says, I still have to pay rent. He can't earn an income, and he still has to pay rent. His business was basically shut down for a few days last month. That's the problem when I think of Eskom. That kind of if you have a monopoly on power, little monopoly on power, and you can't even secure supply, even at what any price consumers willing to pay.
We know that they can't. So yeah. That Eskom is deeply damaged is just a fact. We have to live with it. I mean, how do you fix it? What do you do?
I think.
Why does nobody agree?
I think.
Why is there no agreement on it?
The government has to make a choice. Either it provides power or it saves Eskom. That's the choice. If the government has to say we're going to save Eskom, that means providing power comes second.
Presumably, if the price of Eskom, which the government regulates, the price of electricity were high enough, everybody would want to supply electricity.
Yes.
But we keep it low. So, I mean, what do you do, Julieta? You've got strong views about the future of the country. Mm. What do you do to save Eskom now? This is your call. You're in charge.
Okay. I would try and implement some rigor in terms of the staff that Eskom has.
Yeah.
So if we understand from the World Bank that Eskom is overstaffed by a third, I think you have got to allow management of Eskom to say, right, we have got to cut jobs because we have got to cut costs. Mm. And we clearly are overstaffed. We have an unproductive workforce, and you've got to do something about that, and you've got to let management do something about that.
Yeah.
If you don't, and what is interesting to me is that government is not really letting the natural forces that should come into effect in private companies play
Patrick,
out.
Patrick, is that just pure politics? Is that not before an election, guys?
Yeah, look, I mean, the thing with Eskom is they're a bit like the taxi industry. You know, whereas the taxi industry can block the roads, the workers in Eskom can just switch the lights off. Mm. And, you know, we have had suspicions over the past few months that that certain periods of darkness and so-called load shedding were a factor of unions venting their anger, which is not to say, you know, don't do it, but it comes to the point of cracking the whip. How do you give Eskom management the wherewithal to crack the whip against unions that are allied to the ANC, which runs Eskom and which faces an election, and you know, which is always in a difficult political situation?
But I find that really intriguing, and you probably all know better than I. Why do the unions have so much sway? Their membership has declined. Irvin Jim is running on his own, his own ticket in this election. And you've got, I keep saying the stat, 26.7 million registered voters in South Africa. Union membership is probably no more than a couple of million. I mean, NUMSA is about 340,000 people.
Yeah.
The union membership numbers are not high.
They always say that one of the reasons they've got power is that they're well organized, so that they're better organized than the political parties are. They know more about their members. They know where people are. They're able to, as a political force during an election, you want them in your tent, sort of pissing out rather than the other way around. The threat by the NUM to put the lights off just before the election, it's kind of gone away a little bit, you know. Mm. What's happened to that? That will have been, there have been lots of chats, I guarantee you, with the president and the head of the NPA. You remember the head of, not the NPA, the head of COSATU. The head of COSATU was the person who Jesse Duarte defeated in the last election to become Deputy Secretary General of the ANC. And I'm sure she's a Cyril. Not appointee, but she'd be in Cyril's camp over at COSATU, and I'm sure he'd have some way of talking to them. But before an election, no government would do it. No government would fire all these people.
A government that knew itself and knew what it wanted from the next 5 years, might, and actually. Might be rewarded for that. And I feel that South Africa is paralyzed by fear that we don't make bold decisions and we don't say, to hell with it. This is what we wanted to see happening in our state. Let us go after it. And it will...
The only one able to make decisions really now is still the ANC. I mean, the DA has the cape. and will probably keep the Cape, and I'm sure Alan Windey will be very good there as Premier. But, you know, for the rest of it, you're asking a party that doesn't know its, you know, left from its right hand, basically, to make these big, bold decisions. And they've been brought up on a diet of ideological rubbish. So they have no clue of what's actually possible. You know, they assume capitalism is the enemy. In
so
fact, it's a salvation.
Why are you saying we should vote for the ANC and for
Cyril? Because I'm not voting for the ANC. I mean, I will have to, I suppose, but I'm trying to basically make sure that Cyril Ramaphosa has enough time, as much time as possible, to reform the state, and he's already started doing that. There you go. Well, that's shut everybody up. We'll be back with you next week. Thanks for joining us. See you soon.